Evening, everybody. My name is Rich, and I'm an alcoholic. And you know, it's always truly a blessing when someone asks you to share your experience, strength, and hope. And I want to thank Dan G, for asking me up here, and Auburn Fellowship for having me. And they treated us to pizza tonight, too, which was really nice. Happy birthday to the birthday people, and welcome to the newcomers, and the newcomers coming back. My sobriety date is October 30th, 1997, and October I'll have 6 years, weekends and holidays included. I was born in Springfield, Missouri in 1953, and my dad and my mom weren't always together. They were sometimes together and sometimes not together. My mom had boyfriends, my dad had girlfriends, and there was nothing wrong with that. You know, we moved in little increments in the middle of the night from place to place, you know. You know, that middle of the night thing, you know, I was wondering about that. I was told it was to beat traffic. You know, I don't know how much traffic you can beat out of Springfield, Missouri in 1953, but I believed it, you know. You know, life as a kid was nothing abnormal for me. You know, as you're a kid, you're growing up and you're doing what you're supposed to be doing as a kid, and you don't really notice anything except for the new things that come and you learn from, and you just accept the things that go on. And you know, back then it was white lightning was probably the drug of choice, and they had wet and dry counties, and they would, you know, run alcohol between these counties, and they would sell it back and forth, and most of my in-laws were outlaws, and you know, the thing about, you know, being in an unstable family like that, two brothers and a sister, and sometimes we would be staying with other people, you know, relatives or in-laws or friends, and I remember we were staying with one of my uncles down there in South Little Rock one time, and I don't remember how old I was, but I remember I'd stole some change off his dresser. And I don't remember how old I was, but I remember the ass whooping to this day. You know? And I remember another time when my mom and dad were together, and I don't remember which state we were in or what we were doing. I think we might have been fishing or doing something, but my dad was holding up the fence, this barbed wire fence, so us kids could crawl through, and my mom got there, and he let the barbed wire go, and she says, "Aren't you going to hold that up for me?" He says, "Crawl through on your belly like the snake you are." Yeah, that's the kind of family I had. Yeah. I remember another time when dear old Uncle Johnny, yeah, he was a sight. You know, his only saving grace was he could play guitar. They had four kids in their family also, and we were sitting at the breakfast table one morning. We were staying at their place because that's where we were staying at the time. And Uncle Johnny, I know for a fact I never ever saw him one day sober. He was always drunk, and he come out of the wherever he was coming from that morning. And he comes and he sits straight across from Calvin, his own son, and it's Calvin Abernathy. And Calvin, you see, he was probably about my age, just really young, but he had red hair, he had big freckles, and he had ears out to about here, you know, in that growing stage. And Uncle Johnny sits straight across from him and he says, "Damn it, Mary Lou, how many times have I told you to get this ugly son of a gun away from the table while I'm eating?" Oh, yeah. You know, one of these days, if I hang around long enough, I'm liable to run into Calvin. You know, but there was nothing wrong with that. That's just the way life was. And we moved from state to state, like I say, in little increments. You know, church was always in my house, you know, or in my livelihood, because that's where you went when you got to town to get groceries. Church was where you went to get your school clothes. Church was where you went after you got to town, if you had some kind of staying time, that you went to get your PG&E bill paid. And you see, the kids were always taken along. The kids were taken along for leverage, because if you took your kids, then you were had a much better chance of getting what you were looking for. And over that period of time, I saw lots and lots of different religions. I saw religions where they rolled under benches and jumped over pianos. I saw, you know, back there in the Bible Belt. I'm talking snakes, dancing with snakes in the back room. Nothing abnormal about that, just the way it was. You know, some churches, they had churches where they were standing there talking to you normal, with some with beanies. But, you know, it was always for the wrong reason. School, I was always a new kid in school. I was always in fights. The most schools I went to in 1 year was nine schools in 1 year. You see, and you see, back then, it wasn't split up like it is now. I mean, nine schools in one year, that's like one a month. You know, and probably three different states. You know, and that was normal. The first time I remember drinking alcohol was in one of those moves, and it was in a desert state, probably Texas or someplace like that, Oklahoma or someplace. And I don't remember where we were, but we had ran out of water, but we didn't run out of beer. And that was my first time I was allowed to drink beer. Mom just turned around and said, here, drink some of this. This will take care of your thirst. You know, and there was nothing wrong with that. We moved in little increments, like I said, through the states. And, you know, sometimes we would be living in a house where I was going to school and doing my homework and, you know, getting up and going to school and eating breakfast and doing all that. And sometimes I would be like on a riverbank, in a tent or in a farm labor camp or, you know, in a situation like that where we were staying in tents or in a station wagon. Back then they were called fruit tramps, and we would be picking the fruit. And some mornings, you know, breakfast would be whatever we were picking that morning. Just the way it was. You know, as we slowly moved out to California, I was probably 10 years old or so when I got to San Diego. My dad was working in a gas station, and my mom had swung in through that period of time with a boyfriend. And I don't remember what he did, but he was job-worthy. He had some kind of job skill. And she picked up me and my sister. My brother had stayed. My other brother had already gone off, done something else. I was the baby of the family. So my sister and I ended up with my mom, and she took us, and we went in little increments again up to Oregon. And, you know, I was one of those kids that you see standing out in front of the Salvation Army or the Goodwill in the big cities. You know, you see them with all dirty faces and running around in the streets. That was me. And then just the way it was. When we got to Oregon, like I say, he was job worthy. He had a skill of some kind. I don't remember what it was, but we were staying motel to motel. And one day the cops came to the motel, and they took me and my sister to juvenile detention hall, JDH. And that's when I found out it was not okay to leave your kids in a motel. Well, my sister was older. She had a biker boyfriend, and she ended up eventually moving in with him and getting married. I was younger. I wasn't in that capacity to do anything. I went from JDH, juvenile hall, to foster homes. My first foster home, I was 11 years old. I was introduced to drugs. I ended up slamming acid. And from there on, I was about, it was in my second foster home, I think it was, or third foster home. I had my first girlfriend. I think it was in the eighth grade. And it was kind of funny. Her parents invited me over for dinner. And right after dinner, they said, well, you know, Rich, they said, we kind of like you, but we really don't think that you're ever going to make anything about yourself, and we'd rather you didn't see our daughter again. So in my fourth foster home, 2 weeks into the ninth grade, at 14 years old, I ran away from that home, and I've been on my own ever since. And that's just the way it is, you know, and that's the way it was. And I went from there from Oregon down to California. I started working in a wild boar hunting ranch for room and board in Carmel Valley, up in the mountains above Big Sur, up by Big Sur, and Tassajara Hot Springs. And I got a job. It was a wild boar hunting ranch, and I would take people out on horse pack trips and hunt wild boar and game and deer and quail and pheasant. And in between those hunts, we would split oak And we would take that wood into town in Salinas and Carmel, and we would sell it, you know, at the end of the month. And nothing wrong with that. See, because when we went in and did that, we would take the money from the wood, and we would buy our necessities for going back up to the ranch next month. That would be the sugar, the yeast, you know, for the homemade beer, the store-bought cigarettes, the roll-your-own cigarettes, and then we couldn't forget about alcohol's cousins, you know. Came in tab form and leaf form and mushroom form, and we would take those alcohol's cousins back up with us. But every time we would go back into the ranch, we would stop at a little place called the Stirrup Cup Tavern. That's the last stop before we got out of town. And I remember going into that little bar one night on the way back in, and I remember walking through the door, and I don't remember anything till the next day. I woke up in a field on my back, and it was in the summertime, and the grass was growing straight up alongside me, you know, and there was about three or four kids standing around me. And they're all looking down at me, and one of them saying, "Is he dead? Is he dead?" I opened my eyes up, and I go, "Ah!" And they all took off running, you know. Well, I got up and I looked around. I said, "Where the heck am I? Man, oh man, this must be something." You know, I little did I know it was a blackout. You know, I first thing I figured was aliens. So what I did, you see. Because I sit there and I had to figure this out. And how did I figured out I was about 30 miles from where I should have been. And there ain't no transportation. I still got my wallet. I still got my clothes. I don't know what the hell happened. You know, so I figured, well, at least when I get back to the ranch, those guys that, you know, that I'm working with, they'll tell me what happened. And, you know, they were there. They'll know what happened. So I hitchhiked my way back up to the ranch. And a couple, 3 hours later, I pull in and going into the kitchen, and there they are, they're sitting at the dining room table, and the first thing they say is, "What happened to you?" They didn't know what happened to me either. I just disappeared. So I never did find out what happened. But the thing about it was, is you see, inside I knew something wasn't right. You know, something wasn't right, and if I was going to fix it, I better do it good. So I quit living there, and I hitchhiked my way back up to Oregon. And I started working in a Regal gas station on Northwest 21st and Marshall. I was 16 years old. And everything was going good. I had it going on. I had a little job. I had a little apartment across the street. And except for the fact that I was slamming straight bourbon whiskey and shooting crystal meth, everything would have been just fine. But my health wasn't that good. And I went to put the nozzle of the gas pump behind the license plate of a Chevy, and I stood up and passed out from the rush. I woke up in the hospital, 16 years old. Doctor says, "Kid," he says, "I ain't gonna fool around with you." He says, "If you keep doing what you're doing, you're just flat gonna die." Well, there I was again. I knew if I better do something, I better do it good. I didn't have a high school education. I didn't have my health. I didn't have anything. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a place to live. But they did have the draft. So I enlisted in the Marine Corps. Well, I didn't realize till after I got in there that there was a war going on. But they didn't, you know, I passed the requirements and I was in and I was doing fine. I was at Camp Pendleton, and it was a transition station. If you know Camp Pendleton, the troops would go in and out from there, and you see, they put me as a cook. And I would sit at the EM Club, Enlisted Man's Club, with my buddies, and we would talk about all this alcohol's cousins that was coming in from overseas, you know, in leaf form and brick form and stuff like that. And we were figuring out ways to make money on this. You know, we were doing pretty damn good, you know, sucking back some booze and partying down. And everything was going good until one day the FBI comes knocking on my door, and they said, "What about this murder?" I said, "Well, I don't know what you're talking about." Well, this girl that I was dating, come to find out she was dating another Marine, and she had killed him. Well, you see, the first thing they thought was, there's a triangle going on here, you know what I mean? And there wasn't. There really wasn't. And after the investigation, they realized there wasn't. But what they had realized and found out, well, what was really going on, you know, and my CEO comes up to me, he says, Rich, he says, what else can you do? You see, because in Vietnam back then, and you know, as a cook, you know, I had a low-level security clearance just starting out. You see, a cook can kill a lot of people. So he figured maybe I better change my occupation, change my MOS. And he asked me what else I could do. And I said, well, the only thing I've ever done is work on a wild boar hunting ranch with horses and take people out on pack trips. He says, well, it's special services for you. Well, you know, the first thing you think is special services, the fighting elite, right? Well, in the Marine Corps, everybody is the fighting elite. And special services is the entertainment department. And he stuck me down at the base stables on Camp Pendleton, and I rode rodeo for the rest of my time. I rode bulls and bareback. And I got to wear a cowboy hat. I got to take young, pretty girls out on camp trail rides. And you know what? I got to drink and party and had a ball. I didn't have to face inspections. I didn't have to do anything. I ended up getting out of the Marine Corps with an honorable discharge. Never got busted, never got promoted. I ended up with a PFC, an honorable discharge, Civil Defense Service Medal, Rifle Marksman Badge, Good Conduct Medal, and I got out. And I said, well, I did all right. You know, maybe I should get my GED on my veterans benefits. Well, why not? So I went back up to Oregon, and I started school, and I was doing real good, and I got my GED. But what I did, you see, was along with that GED, was I was really benefiting from what I had benefited from the Marine Corps, and that was my drug connections. And I, same time, a couple of days after I got my GED, I got busted in California for $27,000 worth of PCP that I was flying back and forth interstate. So I was an educated person in jail. And I did a little time in jail, and I got out, and I knew this wasn't working, and I thought to myself, well, if I'm going to change, I better do it good. So I went to Alaska. Why not? You know, I mean, wild frontier. Well, I went to Alaska, and I pulled up into there, and I had my cooking skills, so I got me a job cooking at Leroy's Pancake Palace. And it was 24 hours pancakes, you know, and I had a job just down the street from my apartment, and there was a bar in the middle. And you know where I spent most of my time, you know. If I wasn't at work, I was at the bar, you know. Everything was going good except for, you know, I didn't hardly have any money. The job was dead end, and I was sitting in the bar one day, and a couple stools down, I hear this guy talking, saying, I need a cook bad. Man, I need a cook. And I said, well, you know, I'm a cook. He says, yeah, but I need a good cook. I said, you know how we are. I am a damn good cook. He says, well, let's check you out. So what it ended up being was that Husky Oil Company up on the north slope of Alaska had all these oil rigs and oil situations sitting up with buildings and stuff like that. You see, if you've got an oil well situation going up on the north slope with thousands of miles from anywhere, they're going to fly in all your fluids, like your hydraulic, your gas, and stuff like that for your machines and stuff like that. It's all going to come in 55-gallon drums. So if you have a place like that that's been in operation for 30 or 40, 50 years, you can imagine how many 55-gallon drums they had. They had acres and acres of 55-gallon drums. And these abandoned buildings, and USGS, the government, U.S. Geological Service, comes into Husky Oil Company, and they say, you can't have this. This is environmentally impacted. You got to take care of this. So Husky Oil Company hired the guy, this guy's company that I was working for, which was Environmental Support Services Company. And man, you talk about a job. It was a good job. I finally hit it. I was a cook, first cook. I had a bull cook under me that did all the prep work. We flew up from Anchorage up to Point Barrow, the farthest point north in the United States. We flew by there to a helicopter out to the land, to the well site. We had state-of-the-art tents, and they dropped in diesel engines to run power plants. It was fantastic. I had it going on, you know. I set up the kitchen myself. We had deep fryers, freezers, everything, grills. I cooked for the Eskimos and the crew that were cleaning up the work. And I did my 2 weeks setting up the tent and tents, and then I did a month cooking. And it was $166 a day, day after day after day, three meals a day. I was tax-free, and man, I had it going on. My time was up. The helicopter comes in, takes me up to Point Barrow. They have the company jet. I'd get on the company jet to go back to Anchorage, and the first thing I see when I walk into the jet is a wet bar with cold beer on ice. Well, I ain't had anything for a long time. So that three-hour flight back to Anchorage, I got mine. You know, I got mine. I walked into the office, picked up my check. The boss hands me the check. I said, oh, whoa, wait a minute. You owe me more money. Besides that, I deserve a raise. And your secretary sure got a fine ass. Well, I impressed him. I impressed him. They gave me two checks. That didn't matter. I had it going on. By then, I had it going on. I took both those checks, cashed them, got me the biggest bottle of whiskey, the biggest bag of cocaine, the prettiest blonde, and commenced to spending money. 2 weeks later, I'm sitting with nothing left over but a hangover and a Jones, shaking my head saying, how could you be so stupid? It was a job I could have retired from. You know, and I look back now, and I've been doing that my whole life. That lifestyle from a kid that I learned to live by is what the lifestyle I was living by then. And, you know, I was really in trouble then. You know, I figured if I have to do something, I better do it good. So I got a job driving taxi in Anchorage. Well, it wasn't driving taxi. It was paying this guy at the end of the night to wheel and deal and barter and trade and stolen merchandise and drugs. And everything was going real good. Till I did this one deal. It was a diamond. And it was a pretty good sized diamond. I middlemanned it for 7 pounds of pot, an ounce of cocaine, and $1,000 cash. And a couple days after I did the deal, one of the guys I did the deal for comes up and he says, hey, Rich, he says, you know that diamond you just did? I said, yeah. He says, but you know that wasn't real. Well, these guys I've played with aren't no joke. You know, I knew right away I better do something good if I'm going to do it. And I ain't been back since. And maybe if I hang around long enough, one of those guys, I run into one of those guys, you know, hopefully they'll have done the steps, you know. The thing about it is that, you know, I did that kind of life for a long time. I would go places and do things that would get me in trouble. I would never be able to compromise. I would always work a little, wheel and deal a little, and I would end up in a position where either I had to go or you had to go. And there was no compromise. Somewhere along in the 80s, I remember, I said to myself one day, well, no matter how much money I make, no matter how much I wheel and deal, when I get to the end of the month, I don't have enough money for what I want and the bills too. And I knew right away what the problem was. The IRS. They were taking too much out of my check. So I quit working altogether. And I just started wheeling and dealing. And for the next 10 years or so, I just wheeled and dealed. Now, that was pretty good. That's how I ended up in Lodi, where I live now. I wheeled and dealed myself into a 1965 Dodge Coronet and a 42-foot, 10-wide trailer. The engine on the Dodge blew up, and the trailer went to the dope man. And I ended up living in the street. Well, I can handle this. You know, I know how I'm a man. I can handle this. I can deal with this. So I would quickly learn how to dumpster dive, which I did. And I found out there's a lot of stuff in there worth $20. What I did was I would go into these dumpsters, I would get what I needed to do to hustle and hustle and get what I needed to go and do what I needed to do. And at night I would sleep up under the stairwell or on somebody's back porch when they weren't looking or in a backyard and everything was going good. Till one day it rained. Now this is not good, you know. You can't sleep up under a stairwell or anywhere out there without getting wet, you know. And I thought to myself, well, I can fix this, you know. I'm smart. I figured I'd find me a dumpster that had just a little bit of paper in it and stuff, a small bit of amount of paper, and I'd see at this time, you see, I had a ditty bag, a white laundry bag, you know, string type, white cotton cloth, and I would keep my clothes in there. And I had a blanket wrapped around that, and I would have a belt wrapped around that, and I would have a rope going through it, and I would sling it over my shoulder. And that's what I had going around doing the things I was doing. And what I did was I found me a dumpster with a little bit of paper in it. It said no garbage, best I could do. And I opened the lid up, and the rain's coming down, and I took my blanket off, and I took that off, and I put the paper in like in a spot, and I put my little cloth bag and then my clothes in the bottom, and then I sat on top of that, and I pulled a blanket up on top of me. Close the lid, ding, 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 rain's on the outside, I'm doing fine. I'm in hog heaven. Went to sleep. All of a sudden, boom, I hit the deck. Man, I look up, it's dark, I can't see anything. I look up, see a little square patch of light. I hear this loud roar. I realize I'm inside a garbage truck. Well, when I came in from the, it was the first load. I was the first pickup. It was a top loader. When I came in from the top, there wasn't anything else in there, so I hit the steel deck. And when I did, I banged my knee, and it was on a slow and steady swell. And when I got up to reach out to reach to the lip on the inside, I realized I couldn't reach it. And I couldn't jump because my knee was banged up. And I'm thinking to myself, Rich, you went and screwed up now. You know, and inside my head, I'm thinking, man, Rich, you really messed up. What are you going to do? You don't know what you're going to do. Yeah, you do. You can figure it out. You can't figure it out. Shut up. Let me think. I can't think. Yes, you can. God, I need a drink. And then out loud, I would hear myself say, God, please don't pack me. Well, I went around inside this garbage truck. As we're going down the road, I'm trying to figure out what the heck's going on and what I'm going to do. What I finally did was I took that blanket and I folded it up into the tiniest little square I could and put it right underneath that hole. And I took that bag of clothes that I had and I stuffed it real close, tight, and I put it right on top of that blanket. And then I went up and it was a real kind of, with my good leg, stepped up on it. It was just enough to give me the inch or two that I needed to grab that lip. And I climbed up on out of there, and I'm out there, and I'm just, oh man, the rain's coming down in buckets, and we're going down the road, and I'm working myself down off the side of this garbage truck. We pulled up to the stop sign. I remember I limped off that garbage truck and hobbled over the curb. I remember thinking to myself, Rich, you are one lucky son of a gun. Which I was. I didn't get packed. But you see, from then on, you see, I never slept in a dumpster again. But what I did do and end up doing after that was I would go to find me a bush, someplace where there was a bush that nobody had been in, and I would worm my way up in there, and I would work my way back and forth and wiggle back and forth and break branches, and I would hollow it out on the inside. And then I would go to this place at Helig Myers, this furniture store in Lodi, and I would go over there, and they would get all their furniture in plastic bags, and I would take those plastic bags out of their dumpster, and I would open them up, and I would lie in the inside of the bush where I was at. And I would somewhat stay dry, you know. And, hey, I had it going on. You know, I did that for a long time. I didn't stay underneath the bushes for a couple weeks or a couple months. I lived underneath the bushes for a couple years. And I would wake up underneath those bushes in the morning, stick a needle in my arm, slosh down the last of a 40-ouncer, and go out and hustle breakfast through the trash cans. I wasn't the type of alcoholic when I got to that point. I'd say I was going to kill myself. I was perfectly satisfied with the way I was dying. And I probably would have, too, except for a little bit of God jumped in. I was working a deal. I had I'm a wheeler and dealer. I got it going on. And I was riding my bike. I had one of those little plastic gearing scales with a ounce or 16th of crank in it, wrapped in a hair tie. And I was going down the road, and it was just about dark. And the cop was coming down this way, and I could see him coming. I said, oh, I know he's going to turn around. He's going to pull me over. I just know it. So I took that, and I reached into my pocket, and I wiped it off real quick and kind of flipped it like this as I was riding my bike. And it was this trailer sales place that had over-covered trailers and half-trailers and everything. And I flipped it over the fence, and I seen it cleared the barbed wire, and I took a big sigh and hit that trailer and bounced back off onto the sidewalk in front of me. Well, that cop did not believe that didn't belong to me. So I ended up going to jail. And in San Joaquin County, where I come from, you get your bail in lieu of, you go to ADAP, Alcohol and Drug Prevention Program, and you go there in lieu of your bail. And I went there, they let me out, and I would have to go there every morning, and then every night I would have to leave. And they had the stipulation you couldn't use drugs and da-da-da-da, and they were giving me all the rules. But I only had to go to court for a couple of times. And in the meantime, you see, while I was doing those times waiting for court, the ADAP program told me that I had to do AA meetings, which I did. And I found something real valuable. You know, I didn't have to go to court very long because I threw it out of court, you know, about the bust. But I kept going to AA meetings anyway. I learned something really valuable. As long as I came into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I said I was an alcoholic, I could get all the free coffee I wanted to and get warm. And that's what I came back for. It wasn't to save my butt, to save your butt, to save anybody's butt. It was kind of to come back because there was no place else for me to go. And it was free coffee, and I could look at the girls, and on birthday night, damn it, we had free cake. You know, and that's what I came back for. And I came back for a long time, I'd come up to the steps one day on my fellowship, and this guy's standing on the porch, and it's my sponsor today. But he is standing on the porch, and he says, you know, Rich, he says, if you want to turn your life around and maybe make something of yourself, he says, you know, you got to stop drinking, you got to stop doing drugs both, and he says, if you find that hard to do, you pray. Doesn't matter what you pray. If you don't have a God, borrow one. And come back to meetings and don't drink in between. And I remember the first time he told me that, I knew right away. He was higher than I was. Because there was no way I was going to do that. You know, there was just no way. I mean, you know, they would say, keep coming back. And I'd say, well, you keep making that coffee. They'd say, well, we'll help you if you can help yourself. And I say, well, yeah, I hang around here long enough, I'm going to help myself to something. You can bet on that. You know, I came back a long time, you know, for the wrong reasons. And I had a lot of bushes out there, you know. I had a lot of bushes. I didn't have a bush in one spot. I had bushes all over. And I had a bush in the middle of the freeway one time. I had one down by the graveyard. I had them all over. But it ended up, you see, that one day, I woke up under that bush, and there was something inside me that wasn't right. I knew that one more load of dope, one more load of whiskey, one more case of beer wasn't going to fix. Wasn't going to fix that loneliness and that hole that I had inside, that desperation and that fear. You see, I've been coming into the rooms for the wrong reasons for a long time, but something had rubbed off. And I don't think it was the fact that, you know, that what they said. I think it was more the fact that somebody would always come up to me and pat me on the shoulder and say, hey, how you doing? Welcome back. Keep coming back. You know, I didn't have that feeling of loneliness. I wasn't alone anymore. And one day I woke up under that bush, and I didn't know about detox, and I didn't know about recovery house. I didn't know about any of those places. And I woke up under that bush, and I went back to that sponsor, and he said, well, you know, he said, start eating at the mission and start you know, doing this thing for real, and if you're serious, you know, I'll stand behind you and stuff like that. And I went back to that bush, and I detoxed under that bush, and, you know, sat crawling in a ball and crying, and I came across this, you know, he said to pray and find a prayer. I didn't know anything about praying and prayer and anything like that, and he said, it doesn't matter what you pray. So from that moment, I started praying. I said, thank you, Lord, for loving me. Thank you for forgiving me of my sins. Thank you for keeping me off drugs and alcohol. Because he had taken me off drugs and alcohol just for a few minutes at that time. And I thank you for having your will, your way in my life. And I said that day after day, minute after minute. And I started going to meetings, and I started eating at the mission. And you know, one day I walked up on the porch, and there was my sponsor standing there, and it wasn't my sponsor then. And I said, I'm going to kill my roommate. He looks at me and he says, fool, you don't even have a roommate. You live underneath the bushes. I thought people believed me. Well, it ended up, you know, he said, you know, if you're really serious about doing this thing, he says, how many days you got clean now? I said, I think I got 33 days. He says, well, you know, you can probably pass a drug test once you get a job. I said, wow, now, hey, there's an idea. What an idea. I think I'll do that. So I did. I did exactly that. I went out, and I put applications in every place I could put applications. Any place that somebody would tell me on the newspaper, I put an application in. And, you know, after a couple, 3 weeks, I didn't get no job. See, I had long hair down to my butt. I had a full beard. I had clothes that weren't mine. I had shoes that didn't fit me, and I stunk. And they had to be laughing when I was leaving with these applications. You know, they had to be in stitches. And I did that, you know, and I kept going back. And one day my sponsor, he says, it looks like you're really seriously trying to do this thing. He says, I'll tell you what, I'll pay for a haircut and a shave if you want to try it again. I said, well, okay, evidently my good looks aren't getting me anywhere. So I went back to that barbershop, and I got a haircut and a shave. It was $18 and a $2 tip, a $20 bill to cut the hair off me. Somebody in the rooms gave me some clothes, got a bath. I remember exactly who it was. I was kind of foggy back then. And, you know, I went out for the next couple, 3 weeks, and I put applications in all over. Because, you see, once I got cleaned up, I realized I had no place to put applications in. I put applications in every place I could think of. So I put them in exactly the same places I put them in before. Some people recognized me, and some people didn't, you know. And you know what? In a couple, 3 weeks, I had a job. And it was a place called Valley Industries. And it was right next to the railroad tracks. And this viaduct where the cars went by, up by the back end fence of the, you know, where the, right back here by where I had a bush. And I'd been working there about 4 months. I worked in graveyard. And one of the bosses that I worked with, got along with pretty good, he comes up to me one night and he says, hey, Rich, he says, a couple guys out there drinking. I said, well, who are they? And he goes, they're on the other side of the fence, a couple kids. I said, well, they aren't hurting anybody, you know, cut them some slack. They aren't robbing and stealing from anybody. He says, you know, there used to be a guy that stayed over there. He says, I haven't seen him for a while. I said, well, maybe he got a job. You know what he told me? He said, no, Rich, when they get down that low, they don't get jobs. They OD or they get run over by trains. Man, and it just like hit me like a brick, you know. And I took a little different perception on this program. And I went back and asked that sponsor about those steps. And to the newcomer, the steps. What are the steps? How do they work? What's it all about? What's the mystery about the steps? My opinion, the steps, very simple. Remember how they used to separate the wheat from the chaff? They would throw the wheat up in the air, and as it came back down, the breeze would blow the chaff to the side, and the wheat would come down nice and clean. It's kind of like what happened to me. I got with that sponsor. As he went up with those steps, as I did those steps, I went up in the air with those steps. And as I came back down, the steps blew away the loneliness. the misery, the desperation, the fear, the anxiety that we all know so well, blew it to the side, and brought me down into a place in spirituality where I was okay with me. You know, it taught me a way to let go and let God. You know, everybody said, well, how do you let go and let God? Well, you get on your knees and you ask your God, whoever it may be, to take the misery off your shoulders. You know, I ask him to take the misery off my shoulders. This burden is too heavy. And if I get up and I walk away and I forgot about that problem, then I've succeeded. I've let go and let God. But if I get on my knees and I got a burden and I pray and I get up and I still hang with it and I can't get rid of it and I can't shake it and it bugs me, I know one thing. If I found that place inside my heart, or inside my chest, where that loving, caring, touching hand of God lives once, that I should be able to find it again. So I keep trying and I keep trying until I find that peace and that balance that I need so much today in my life. You know, I got up out of the bathroom shower the other day and I got a scale right down by my sink. I pulled it out with my foot like I usually do. Got up on it. 185 pounds. I'm like, ooh, man. If I let go of anything, I better let go of some of them donuts. Went to kick it back underneath there, you know, and it hit the door jamb, went to the side. So I reached down and I pulled it in with my hand. And as I did, I looked at it and it was 10 pounds overweight. Wow. So I adjusted it, pulled it back over, got up on it, 175 pounds. I look pretty damn good. You see, the problem is up here. It's up here. You know, I was taking some Microsoft tests. I have, since from no education, I've gone back and I have 3 Microsoft certifications today. And I was taking those tests. They were $100 a pop back then, and I failed 6 in a row. And boom, 1, 2, 3, 4. Man, I would get out to my car and I would lower my head and I would say that prayer that I always pray. Thank you, Lord, for loving me. Thank you for giving me my sins. Thank you for keeping me out of drugs and alcohol. Thank you for having your will, your way in my life. Help me to be like I'm supposed to be, act like I'm supposed to act, and think like I'm supposed to think. And you know what? It didn't change the score on those tests. But it did change the way I felt about the score on those tests, you see. And it brought me to a place where I could be good, be, you know, okay with myself. You see, I found out life out there beats me up the same way it beats everybody up. The same way it used to beat me up years ago, it beat me up the same way today. The only difference is, today, you see, I have a different set of tools, a different design for living. The design for living I was brought up with and raised with from a kid was total destruction. I would have, the answer to my problems was in a bottle or in a bag. The misery was living with no way out and not knowing it. The tools I used was lies and deceit. And the tools I use today in this program, faith, honesty, hope, generosity, compassion, those tools, doing speaker meetings, reading the book, being a sponsor, being a good sponsee, doing H&I, those are the tools I use today. Those tools that I used to use took me where I ended up. The tools I use today take me where I'm going. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams today. You know, I never expected it. You know, all my life, I went through, I don't think anybody can believe, except for me, the reality of the loneliness of the life I had. You know, today it's not like that. You know, I have friends in Alcoholics Anonymous today that are more than just friends. They're family. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me a new design for living. I've gone back, like I said, with my Microsoft certifications. I have 27 copyrights registered with my poetry in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. I never even knew I could write. I have a short story for kids. I didn't even like kids. I'm trying to get it published, you know. I send it out all the time. It's not going anywhere. You never know, though. You know, God works in mysterious ways, you know. I have a house today that I live in, an apartment, not a house, an apartment, that I've been in for 5 years. October will be 5 years. I never lived in any place for over 6 months. My whole life. I had no desire to live any other way than what I knew. And it was okay to live that way. But as I get into sobriety, I find out that it's not okay to live the way I used to live. You see, I don't try today to be the person I should be. I try today to not be the person I was. Because you see, the way I was is so familiar. You know, the way I was is so easy to fall into. The way I was is, you know, if I go back out, okay, I just don't go out and have one bottle of beer. I've been over that line so far for so long that I go over to the line and then over to the cliff and over the, down to the ground, and I'm going to die, and I know that. But fear of dying isn't utmost in my thoughts today. Service is utmost in my thoughts today. I have sponsees I get into service with. I take them through the steps. My job as a sponsor isn't to be a bank account for my sponsees or a marriage counselor or a judge or a jury or none of that. My job is very simply to get with that other alcoholic, take him through the steps so that he can find a God of his own understanding that will answer his problems. I can't answer his problems. I'm not his answers. Humans will fail. God won't. You know, I found that out. I pray because it works. You know, I have a faith today in my life, not because of what I say, but because of what I do. You know, my sponsor, I remember my sponsor, not for what he's told me, but for what he's done for me and what he's shown me. He's done the footwork. This program is about doing the footwork. You can read the book. You can read the steps on the wall. You can read the traditions on the wall and say, oh, yeah, I understand them. But it's not about the program if you just understand them. This program is about getting up off your butt, getting a sponsor, reaching out there, that newcomer, reach out to that person that you think that you're compatible with, the one that you work with, the one that sounds good to you, the one that you get along with, the one that you understand, the one you relate to. Grab that person and say, hey, I want to go through the steps. Because the steps, you see, are the answer to this program. When I got here, I thought to myself, man, 45 years wasted. I just turned 50 last month. 45 years wasted. I could have been somebody. Then I thought to myself, well, after I got in here, I can be somebody. I did the steps, and I realized I was somebody. And you know, I think, well, how can I be a better person tomorrow? I found out I don't have to be a better person tomorrow. There's this little space and time called right now. And it's right now. If I'm doing the best I can do right now, to be the best I can be right now, if I'm not lying and cheating a little bit right now, then as this little space and time inches its way into tomorrow, when tomorrow gets here, I'll be the person I'm supposed to be. You know, to the newcomer, it makes no difference where you came from, what kind of headache you got on you, whether it's the judge, the court, the IRS, the ex-wife, the ex-husband, makes no difference. If you come into this program, take it as a way of life. Put it as a design for living. Get a sponsor. Take it not as an event, but as a way of life. Your life will change. You won't be the same person. Your opportunities will be unending. The doors will open for you. You know, when I got here, you know, it's no comparison to what I have today. If I fail in being in service and stop doing what I'm doing, if I fail to plug into that 11th step, that 10th, 11th, and 12th step on a daily basis, I'm in jeopardy. Everything I have, everything I've been given by my higher power, all the gifts, all the blessings, will fit in a bottle and a spoon with room to spare. And I know that. Thanks.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.